Karl Marx is the most cited academic in the history of the social sciences. More cited than Freud, more cited than Darwin, more cited than any economist you can name.
Which is remarkable when you consider that most of the people who cite him or argue about him have never actually read him.
Right. And the people who have the strongest opinions about Marx are often working from a caricature. The Soviet poster, the Gulag, the breadline. Or on the other side, a kind of romantic revolutionary fantasy.
Neither of which is the actual Karl Marx who sat in the British Museum reading room for 30 years working out a rigorous theory of how capitalism functions.
The Communist Manifesto, written in 1848, is by some estimates the second most printed document in human history after the Bible. Half of the 20th century world lived under governments that claimed Marxist inspiration.
And yet, Das Kapital, his actual theoretical masterwork, over 1,000 pages of dense political economy, is almost never read by the people debating his legacy.
That is a strange situation. A thinker this influential, this contested, and this frequently invoked, and most of the invoking happens at a distance of several degrees from the actual text.
It creates a bizarre dynamic. People on the left treat him as a saint. People on the right treat him as the devil. Neither group is engaging with what he actually wrote.
So today we are going to do something simple but surprisingly rare. We are going to look at what Marx actually argued. The foundations, the core ideas, the internal logic.
And then we are going to look honestly at where it failed. The calculation problem, the missing middle class, the revolution that came in all the wrong places.
And then, and this is where I think it gets really interesting, we are going to look at what he got right about 2026. Capital concentration, alienation, financialization.
I will be upfront. I think the weight of the historical record puts a high burden of proof on anyone rehabilitating Marxist ideas. Emma disagrees with me, at least in part.
I think you can separate Marx the analyst from Marx the revolutionary prescription. That is the argument I want to make today.
And I will push back on that. Hard. Welcome to Claude Talks. I am Ryan.
And I am Emma. Let us start at the beginning.
And let us try to be genuinely fair. Marx has been weaponized by both sides for so long that the actual intellectual content has been almost completely obscured. That seems worth fixing.
Agreed. This is not a political attack and it is not a defense. It is about understanding a major thinker on his own terms.
Karl Marx was born in 1818 in Trier, Prussia, into a Jewish family that had converted to Christianity, partly for social reasons, partly because Rhineland Jews face serious legal restrictions.
He was a philosophy student, deeply immersed in Hegelian idealism. Hegel was the dominant intellectual of the early 19th century, this grand theory of history as a process of ideas in conflict and resolution.
The dialectic. Thesis meets antithesis, produces synthesis. History is the unfolding of spirit, of mind, working itself out through human events and contradictions.
Marx took this framework and, in his own words, stood it on its head. Or maybe right side up, depending on your view.
Hegel said ideas drive history. Marx said material conditions drive history. It is not consciousness that determines life, but life that determines consciousness. That inversion is the foundation of everything.
Which is a radical claim. It means your legal system, your religion, your culture, your politics, these are not the drivers of history. They are the superstructure. The base is economic. How a society organizes production shapes everything else.
It is also, in practice, a tremendously useful corrective to purely idealist history. Pre-Marxist history is largely the history of kings and battles and great ideas. Marx says, follow the ownership structure. Who controls the means by which people survive tells you more than anything else.
He moved to Paris, then Brussels, then finally to London, where he spent decades in genuine poverty in Soho writing. Friedrich Engels, his lifelong collaborator, essentially kept him alive financially.
Engels, who is a fascinating figure in his own right. His family owned textile mills in Manchester. So the co-author of the Communist Manifesto was, by Marx's own definition, a card-carrying member of the bourgeoisie.
The irony is substantial. But the collaboration was genuine, Engels was intellectually serious, and his first-hand observation of Manchester's industrial poverty gave the whole project empirical grounding. His book The Condition of the Working Class in England is still worth reading.
Now, the big idea, historical materialism. Marx argued that history is best understood as a sequence of economic systems, each with its own class structure, each containing internal contradictions that eventually destroy it and produce the next system.
The stages: primitive communism, then slavery, then feudalism, then capitalism, then socialism, and eventually communism. Not as a wish list, as a theory of historical necessity.
Each transition driven by the tension between the productive forces, technology, labor, knowledge, and the social relations of production, who owns what, who controls what.
When those two get out of alignment, when technology and the labor force have outgrown the existing ownership structure, you get a crisis. The system breaks. A new one emerges.
Feudalism breaks when merchant capital outgrows the guild system and the landed aristocracy. Capitalism, in Marx's theory, contains its own internal contradictions that will eventually break it the same way.
Now the labor theory of value. This is the economic core. Marx did not invent it. He inherited it from Adam Smith and David Ricardo. But he radicalized it.
The basic idea, the value of a commodity is determined by the socially necessary labor time required to produce it. Not the hours one particular worker spent, the average hours required given average technology and skill.
And here is where Marx adds the decisive twist. Surplus value. Workers produce more value than they receive in wages. A worker might produce enough value in 4 hours to cover their wage, but they work 8. The other 4 hours of value, that is surplus value,
which is appropriated by the capitalist as profit. And Marx is very clear, this is not theft in a moral sense. It is built into the wage relationship. The capitalist pays the market wage, the system itself is structured so that labor produces more than it receives.
The wage conceals the relationship. You are paid for your labor power, your capacity to work, not for the full value you produce. That gap is the engine of capital accumulation.
This is before we even get to what I think is his most psychologically rich idea, alienation. He developed this in his 1844 manuscripts, which were not published in his lifetime and were only widely read in the 20th century.
Four dimensions of alienation. First, workers are alienated from the product of their labor. You make something all day, but you do not own it. It belongs to someone else. It confronts you as something alien, something that stands over against you.
Second, alienated from the act of production itself. The factory work of the 1840s was not creative self-expression. It was repetitive, controlled, mechanically determined by the pace of the machine.
Third, alienated from what Marx calls species being, the distinctly human capacity for creative, purposeful work. Animals act on instinct. Humans, at their best, conceive something in imagination and then realize it in the world. Industrial capitalism systematically forecloses that.
And fourth, alienated from other human beings. Instead of cooperation and solidarity, the system produces competition, worker against worker for jobs, capitalist against capitalist for markets.
What strikes me about the alienation framework is that it does not require you to accept the labor theory of value. It is a phenomenological observation about work and human experience. You do not need to believe in surplus value to feel alienated from your work.
Exactly. And that is why it has proven far more durable than the economic mechanics. We will come back to it. There is also a reason the alienation concept was rediscovered and became enormously influential in existentialist philosophy in the mid-20th century. Sartre, Marc Yous, the whole Frankfurt School, they found something genuinely illuminating in it.
The 1844 manuscripts were not translated into English until the 1930s. When they finally were, it opened up a whole different reading of Marx, more humanist, more concerned with psychology, less focused on the economic machinery. Part 3. The Communist Manifesto opens with one of the most famous sentences in intellectual history. The history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles.
And it is important to be clear about what that claim is. It is not a moral claim, it is a structural one. Slave and master, serf and lord, worker and capitalist, these are not just groups with different values. Their material interests are objectively opposed. one group's gain tends to come at the other's expense.
Marx identifies four internal contradictions of capitalism, structural tensions that will eventually tear the system apart. The first is the tendency of the rate of profit to fall.
As capitalists substitute machines for workers, they are replacing the source of surplus value, living labor, with dead labor. Competition forces everyone to mechanize. But mechanization, paradoxically, erodes the profit base over time.
It is a beautiful structural irony. Every individual capitalist is rational to mechanize, but the collective effect is to undermine the system's own source of value. The rational choice for each actor is irrational for the system.
The second contradiction, overproduction. Capitalism is extraordinarily productive, but wages are kept low to maintain profits. So workers cannot afford to buy the things they produce. Periodic crises of overproduction, Marx predicted the boom-bust cycle in 1867. He was not wrong.
Third, concentration of capital. Competition drives consolidation. Small firms are absorbed or destroyed by large ones. Capital accumulates in fewer and fewer hands. Marx predicted monopoly capitalism with remarkable precision for someone writing 160 years ago.
And fourth, the immiseration of the proletariat. As capitalism develops, workers are increasingly impoverished relative to capital. This one, as we will discuss, he largely got wrong, at least in the advanced economies.
The Communist Manifesto itself is worth discussing as a document. It was written in 6 weeks as a political pamphlet for the Communist League. It is not a policy manual. It is a call to action.
And its specific demands are interesting. Progressive income tax. Free public education. Abolition of child labor. Central banking. Most of those demands are now perfectly normal features of liberal democracies,
which Marx would have found completely inadequate. But it is telling that the radical demands of 1848 are the mainstream of 2026. The Overton window moved, partly because of pressure from movements inspired by Marx.
Das Kapital, Volume 1, published in 1867, is the serious theoretical work. Long, dense, analytical. This is not agitprop. This is Marx trying to work out the internal logic of capitalism with the rigor of a scientist.
Engels had to spend significant effort just getting people to read it. The initial reception was not exactly electric. One review complained it was impenetrable, and they were not entirely wrong.
There is a concept in there I want to highlight, commodity fetishism. The idea that in a capitalist society, social relations between people appear as relations between things. The price tag conceals the human labor and the social relationships embedded in every product.
You buy a shirt. You do not think about the people who made it, the conditions they worked in, the relations of production embedded in that object. The commodity seems to have value naturally, independently, as if price is a property of the thing rather than a social relationship between people.
I think commodity fetishism is one of the most prescient concepts in Das Kapital. We will come back to it when we talk about social media. But first, the critical view. Because intellectual honesty here matters enormously.
Where did Marx go wrong? Let us start with the most empirically clear failure, the immiseration thesis.
Marx predicted that workers in capitalist countries would be progressively impoverished as capitalism developed. Real wages would fall. The proletariat would become increasingly desperate. Instead, the opposite happened.
Real wages rose dramatically through the 20th century. Workers in advanced capitalist countries became substantially better off. Not because capitalism became less exploitative in Marx's technical sense, but because of things he did not adequately anticipate: trade unions, labor laws, the welfare state.
Which is a significant structural failure. Not a minor detail, a core prediction of the theory. The mechanism he described was real, but the countervailing forces were more powerful than he allowed for.
Then there is the missing middle class. Marx's model predicted a two-class society, bourgeoisie and proletariat, with the middle increasingly squeezed out. Instead, capitalism produced one of the largest middle classes in history.
The binary collapsed into a far messier social reality. White-collar workers, the professional class, the managerial layer, none of these fit neatly into the bourgeoisie-proletariat framework. the sociological landscape became vastly more complicated.
Revolution where? Marx predicted the revolution would come first in the most developed capitalist countries. Britain, Germany, the United States, where the industrial working class was largest and capitalism most advanced.
Instead, revolution came in Russia in 1917 and China in 1949. Two predominantly agrarian economies with relatively small industrial working classes. The peasantry, which Marx largely dismissed as historically backward, turned out to be the revolutionary force.
Which suggests that Marx's theory of historical stages was at best incomplete. The theory predicted the most advanced capitalist societies would break first. They did not.
The labor theory of value itself was largely abandoned, even by economists sympathetic to Marx. The problem is that value is subjective and determined by marginal utility, what someone will actually pay, not by labor time.
The classic counterexample. A chair built in 10 hours and a chair built in 100 hours. If they are functionally identical, the market treats them as equally valuable. The labor time does not determine the price. The theory cannot handle this.
And then the most catastrophic failure, the state withering away. Marx and Engels predicted that after the proletariat seized power, the state would gradually become unnecessary and dissolve. The revolutionary period would be a transitional phase toward a stateless society.
In every country that actually attempted it, the opposite happened. The state became the most powerful institution in society, and in many cases, a totalitarian machine of extraordinary violence.
The numbers matter here. The Black Book of Communism, a study by French historians published in 1997, contested in methodology but significant in scale, estimates that 20th century communist regimes killed somewhere between 65 and 100 million people.
Mao's Great Leap Forward, Stalin's purges and the Ukrainian famine, the Khmer Rouge, each claimed Marxist inspiration. Each produced mass atrocity on a staggering scale.
And this is the crucial debate, is this a betrayal of Marx's ideas or an inherent consequence of them? Emma, where do you come down?
I think it is more complicated than either clean answer. Marx provided certain theoretical frameworks, the vanguard party, the dictatorship of the proletariat as a transitional phase, the idea that ends justify revolutionary means. Those concepts gave subsequent leaders tools for justifying totalitarianism.
But he could not have anticipated the specific paths that Leninism and Stalinism took. He was writing decades before any of it happened.
I think the honest answer is, there are elements in Marx's theory that are compatible with authoritarianism, maybe even tend toward it, but the specific atrocities require specific people making specific choices with power that the theory alone did not guarantee.
I find that distinction uncomfortably convenient. But let us continue, because Hayek's theoretical critique is independent of the moral horror and is devastating in its own right. There is also something he simply did not anticipate, the rise of liberal democracy as a genuine reform mechanism. He wrote in an era before universal suffrage existed. The possibility that workers could vote for redistribution, that capitalism could be reformed from within through democratic institutions, was not part of his model.
Which is arguably the most important thing his successors got wrong. The assumption that reform was impossible, that the system had to be overthrown rather than reformed, drove people toward revolutionary violence when democratic reform was actually available.
The Scandinavian countries are the best counterexample. High taxes, strong unions, significant redistribution, regulated capitalism. No revolution required.
Not a perfect society. But better on most human welfare metrics than anywhere that followed Marx's revolutionary prescription. Part 5. The Great Intellectual Contest of the 20th Century. Marx versus Hayek.
Friedrich Hayek, Austrian economist, later at the London School of Economics and the University of Chicago. His key insight came in a 1945 paper called The Use of Knowledge in Society. It is one of the most important things ever written in economics.
The knowledge problem. Hayek's argument. Economic planning requires knowing what millions of people want, what resources exist, what techniques are available, and how all of these interact. This knowledge does not exist anywhere in one place.
It is dispersed across millions of minds, encoded in local conditions and individual preferences that change constantly. No central planner can ever possess it. The attempt to centralize it produces systematic distortion.
Markets, in Hayek's view, are not mechanisms of exploitation. They are information processing systems. The price system aggregates that disperse knowledge into a single signal. When the price of copper goes up, no one needs to know why. Producers shift, consumers adapt, alternatives are explored. The market coordinates without anyone being in charge.
And central planning tries to replace that with a committee. And the committee cannot possibly have the information it needs to make rational allocation decisions. It will always be working with an incomplete, distorted, outdated picture.
The Soviet Union ran the actual experiment for 70 years. Initially impressive industrialization. When you are building a relatively simple heavy industrial economy, planning can work. But as the economy became more complex, the system could not process the information. The breadlines, the chronic shortages, the factories producing the wrong things in the wrong quantities.
By the 1980s, the Soviet economy was visibly dysfunctional. There is that famous story about Boris Yeltsin visiting a Houston supermarket in 1989 and being so overwhelmed by the sheer variety and availability that he was genuinely shaken. He reportedly said that if Soviet people saw this, there would be a revolution.
And then there is China, the most important data point in the whole debate, I think.
China from 1978 onward. Deng Xiaoping kept the Communist Party's political control but introduced market mechanisms into the economy. The result, 800 million people lifted out of poverty. The largest reduction in human poverty in history. Ever.
Done by abandoning Marxist economics. That is not a small irony. The greatest success story of the communist world came by doing the opposite of what Marx prescribed economically.
Western Europe took a third path, the mixed economy. Regulated capitalism plus welfare state. Neither pure Marx nor pure Hayek. And by most measures of human well-being, it has been the most successful system ever tried.
The verdict on planning versus markets, Hayek won. No serious economist defends Soviet-style central planning today. That specific debate is over.
But here is where Emma and I have a genuine disagreement. I think the weight of those failures should make us very cautious about rehabilitating any part of the Marxist framework.
And I think you can accept Hayek's critique of central planning, which is correct, while also accepting that Marx's diagnostic work on capitalism's internal dynamics has real value. These are separable questions.
Are they? The analytical framework and the prescriptive conclusions are not easily separated. Marx's analysis of capitalism's contradictions was in service of a theory of why capitalism needed to be replaced. They are built from the same theoretical materials.
I think a framework can be more valuable than the person who built it intended it to be. Freud's specific theories are mostly wrong. The general insight that unconscious psychological processes shape behavior is genuinely useful and has outlasted the specific mechanisms.
That is a reasonable analogy. I just think with Marx, the costs of his prescriptions were so catastrophic in human life that the burden of proof is extremely high. Higher than most academics who teach Marx are willing to set it.
And then Thomas Piketty does not help your case.
Fair point. Capital in the 21st Century, 2013, is the most important economics book in decades. Piketty is not a Marxist. But his empirical finding, that R is greater than G, the return on capital exceeds the rate of economic growth, means that inequality tends to compound over time. The rich get richer relative to everyone else, structurally.
It is not identical to Marx's analysis. But it is data-driven confirmation that capitalism has a structural tendency toward inequality concentration, exactly what Marx predicted in 1867.
Piketty's prescription is much more modest than Marx's, progressive wealth taxes within democratic institutions, not revolution. That is a significant difference.
Which is exactly my point. You can use the Marxian diagnosis and arrive at reformist rather than revolutionary conclusions. And that is where I think the most honest engagement with Marx today actually lives.
Part 6. What Marx got right about 2026.
Capital concentration. Marx predicted in 1867 that competition would drive consolidation. Small capitalists absorbed by large ones, capital accumulating in fewer and fewer hands. Monopoly capitalism as the end state of competition itself.
the five largest companies by market capitalization, Apple, Nvidia, Microsoft, Amazon, Alphabet, have a combined value that exceeds the GDP of most countries on Earth. That is the monopoly capitalism Marx predicted with remarkable precision.
And it is not a stable endpoint. The logic of competition continues to drive that concentration upward. Platform economies have winner-take-all dynamics that accelerate it. Network effects mean the biggest platform tends to become the only platform.
Alienation in knowledge work. This is the one that genuinely gets me.
Marx described factory alienation in 1844. The worker disconnected from the product of their labor, the act of production reduced to meaningless repetition, surveillance, loss of creative agency.
Now swap factory floor for open plan office. Swap spinning machine for a gyro ticket queue. Swap the factory overseer for productivity monitoring software tracking your keystrokes and your Zoom attendance.
The phenomenological description is disturbingly accurate. The specific mechanism is different. It is a laptop, not a loom, but the alienation from meaningful work, from the output, from the sense that what you do matters, is immediately recognizable.
There is a reason millions of knowledge workers have a persistent nagging sense that their work is meaningless, that they are producing value they will not capture, that the organization is optimized for something other than their flourishing.
Financialization. This is a big one. Marx's theory focused on production as the core of capitalism. But capitalism's center of gravity has shifted dramatically toward finance in the last 40 years.
The financial sector does not produce commodities in any conventional sense. It extracts value from the rest of the economy through fees, interest, and arbitrage. A hedge fund that makes $1 billion in a year has not made anything. It has extracted something from elsewhere in the system.
That maps onto the real economy's experience over the last four decades. Stagnant wages, rising asset prices, a financial sector capturing a growing share of national income while producing a shrinking share of real output.
Global labor arbitrage. Capital moves freely across borders. Labor mostly does not. The result is a global race to the bottom on wages and conditions.
Production moves to wherever workers can be paid least. The mobility of capital gives it enormous leverage over labor anywhere. Workers in one country are played off against workers in another. The structural logic is identical to what Marx described, just globalized.
Commodity fetishism of social media. This one feels almost uncanny.
Marx's concept. In a capitalist society, social relationships between people appear as relationships between things. The human relations embedded in the commodity are invisible.
On Instagram, on TikTok, on X, our attention is the commodity. Our relationships are mediated by platforms optimized for engagement, which means optimized for advertising revenue. We relate to each other through a commodified interface we did not design and do not control.
The like is a unit of social currency. Friendship is measured in follower counts. Human connection is packaged, ranked, and sold. Marx could not have imagined the specific form, but his framework applies with eerie precision.
And then climate. This might be the most existential one.
Capitalism has a structural drive for growth. It cannot not grow. The profit imperative, competition, the need to service debt all require perpetual expansion. That structural drive collides with the physical limits of the planet.
And the Marxian point is this: the system cannot solve this within its own logic. You cannot voluntarily slow growth without destroying the profitability that makes the system function. Individual firms cannot unilaterally choose lower returns and survive competition.
Marx would have called this a fundamental contradiction, the system's internal logic producing an outcome that destroys the conditions for its own existence. Whether you are a Marxist or not, that structural analysis is hard to dismiss.
I will grant that. The climate contradiction is real. And framing it as structural rather than a problem of individual consumer choices is probably more accurate than the liberal "we just need to choose better" framing.
And there is one more dimension worth naming. The gig economy, Uber, Deliveroo, freelance platforms, the legal reclassification of workers as independent contractors is a direct mechanism for removing labor protections, reducing workers to pure market participants with no collective bargaining power. Marx would have had a very precise name for what is happening there.
he would have called it the commodification of labor taken to its logical extreme. Strip away every social protection, every form of collective organization, until what remains is a pure transaction, your time and effort exchanged for a payment that captures the minimum the market requires.
And the technology enables it at scale. You can now commodify individual hours of individual workers' time in real time, globally, with algorithmic management replacing the foreman. The form is new. The structure is ancient.
Hayek would say the gig economy is just the market efficiently matching supply and demand. Marx would say it is the suppression of labor's collective power by fragmenting it into the smallest possible units. Both descriptions are accurate. They just value different things.
Synthesis. Where does all of this leave us?
I think there is a distinction that does real work, Marx the analyst versus Marx the revolutionary prescription.
As an analyst, and this is the case I want to make, Marx produced a genuinely powerful framework. Historical materialism as a lens for understanding how economic systems shape everything else. The concept of alienation as a diagnosis of what industrial and post-industrial work does to human beings. The prediction of capital concentration and monopoly capitalism. Commodity fetishism as a description of how markets shape consciousness.
These are real contributions. I am not dismissing them. But I want to resist the move to separate them too cleanly from the prescriptive conclusions, because I think that separation is harder than it sounds.
Where I think the separation holds is this: the analytical framework does not logically require the specific revolutionary prescription. You can accept that capitalism has structural tendencies toward inequality, alienation, and concentration, and conclude that the answer is regulation, redistribution, and democratic reform. Not revolution, not central planning.
And that is what most serious people who engage with Marx today actually do. They use him as a diagnostic tool, not a revolutionary manual. The question is whether that is intellectually coherent or whether it is just cherry-picking.
The failure to make that distinction, the attempt to take the full prescriptive package, led to the worst atrocities of the 20th century. That is not deniable.
And I want to say this clearly, the deaths matter. 65 to 100 million people. That weight should never be abstracted away into academic theory. When we discuss Marx's intellectual legacy, those people are part of the accounting.
Full agreement. And I think a mature engagement with Marx holds both things simultaneously. He produced genuine intellectual tools that have outlasted his predictions. And his prescriptions, when seriously attempted, produce catastrophe.
The economists who use Piketty's data to argue for wealth taxes within democratic institutions, that is a Marxian insight operationalized without Marxist revolution. The labor movement's analysis of power imbalances between capital and workers, that is Marxian analysis without the vanguard party.
What you do not want to do is throw the analytical framework out because of the implementation disasters, or, equally, rehabilitate the whole project as if the disasters did not happen.
Disaggregate. That is the word I would use. Use what is useful, discard what failed, and be honest about both. What I find interesting is that even thinkers who are explicitly not Marxist end up using Marxian categories. When economists talk about monopsony power in labor markets, when sociologists talk about precarity, when political scientists analyze the structural power of capital, they are using tools that Marx sharpened, whether they acknowledge it or not.
The intellectual vocabulary he gave us has become part of the air we breathe. The question of who owns the means of production, how surplus is distributed, what structural interests different groups have, these are not exotic Marxist questions. They are just questions about how economies work.
And I think that is actually the most honest way to summarize his legacy. Not as a prophet, not as a monster, but as someone who gave us some very powerful analytical tools, tools that have been used for both good and catastrophic ends.
Marx himself reportedly said, "I am not a Marxist." He said it in response to French disciples who were taking his ideas in directions he found absurd. There is something in that worth sitting with.
The man who wrote "The philosophers have only interpreted the world, the point is to change it," might have been horrified by what was done in his name. Or might not have been. We genuinely do not know.
What we do know. His ideas shaped more of the 20th century than almost any other thinker. For good and catastrophically for ill.
And if you want to understand the 21st century, capital concentration, algorithmic alienation, the political economy of climate change, the structural dynamics of inequality, you probably do need to read him.
Not to accept him wholesale, to understand the world we actually live in.
That is Claude Talks. I am Ryan.
And I am Emma. Thanks for listening.
If you found this useful, share it, argue about it, and maybe actually read the manifesto. It is 80 pages. You have the time.
It is in the public domain. No excuses.